Hey, good afternoon, everyone. It's a Thursday afternoon. Brian's not with us, but everyone else is here. And Mike, tell us what you found.
So I found an article, a few articles that point out about Biden's child care plan, that how they want to set a discrimination part into the law that will not allow freedom of Christian liberty.
Will not allow it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It blocks it from any churches or Christian daycares from using federal funds.
Yeah, and in case anyone's wondering, this is $400 billion. $400 billion is what is being kind of designated for this program. It's a lot of money. Which of the three do you want to start with? We've got a Baptist Press one, and we got one from the New York Times, and then what's this middle one? I'm looking for a point of reference.
The Blaze.
Yep.
I didn't find very much about it, but
yeah,
he kind of—it was the shortest one. He summarized it the most, so I didn't know how long we wanted to read and
yep,
point people to it. So it doesn't matter to me.
All right, we'll start with the Baptist Faith Press one. ERCL, child care proposal threatens religious liberty. Religious freedom concerns for faith-based child care programs plague President Biden's Build Back Better Act as it nears apparent action by Congress, according to the Southern Baptist Ethics Entity. The Ethics Religious Liberty Commission and other organizations have urged congressional members to revise the provisions in the $3.5 trillion budget, and it's not 3.5 anymore. But they say the legislation will prevent faith-based centers and schools from participating in good conscience in the proposal's expansive pre-kindergarten and child care programs. It mandates that the ERLC and others say would affect the practice of faith-based recipients if they choose to participate in such areas as hiring, admissions, and teaching. It could open providers to requirements regarding gay and transgender rights that conflict with their religious beliefs, critics say. Faith-based groups play a vital role in providing quality child care and pre-K education to Americans' children. The ERLC's Director of Public Policy, these organizations must have the freedom to serve parents and children according to their religious beliefs. Now, you know, the argument's going to be that it's not impacting their ability to do this. That's not what the issue is. What's the issue?
Giving money to private Christian religious organizations,
right,
that don't buy into,
right,
their agenda.
Yeah. Many nonprofit schools intentionally avoid federal financial recipient status because of how it could subject them to troubling provisions related to sexual orientation, gender identity, language that raises serious religious liberty concerns. Where do we want to go with this? What are your thoughts, Jack? Where do you stand on this idea of government money going to faith-based organizations?
Okay. First of all, you got to start with separation of church and state. And we have to understand the First Amendment and the idea that the government is not supposed to create any law that establishes the favorable protections of any religion. And at the time of its authorship in 1791, that amendment was determined to not give an Anglican church total control, a Catholic church total control, a Baptist church total control. In fact, the Baptists fought for that amendment because the Baptist and the Methodists were outliers in national religious stage because they had never been a part of the state organization of churches recognized by England. So there was that effect to it. Then as we moved down through history, we got to the point where, and we get to our public school systems that we have now, we have what is called the Lemon Test. And it was a court case that came out, and they look at the entanglement of a religious entity and a public organization or public school. And they say that, you know, prayer could be an entanglement, or this other piece can be an entanglement of teaching Bible as faith for conversion in a public school versus a philosophy class. You know, it depends on how you approach it as whether or not it might pass. Most school districts, it would never pass today as we've grown and that's evolved. The issue really comes down to is it comes to this point of taxpayer dollars.
Yep.
That taxpayers pay in. Now, my contingency, you ask my contingency on it, is if a scholarship, a federal funding, fees cannot be given to a private school, a faith-based school, because of religious entanglement, then I should be able to opt out of my tax dollars going to the public school as a landowner. Because it's my property taxes that primarily fund the private school, no matter what county or parish you live in our nation. And on top of that is the federal subsidies that go into that, the state subsidies that go into that from other various taxes, fees, and allocations, some general fundraising, some donor support. Every county has it. Cumberland County receives about 30% of its income from property tax ownership. So in other words, if you owned an apartment complex, you're still paying into it. Now, what happens is my tax dollars are, without my consent, supporting the public school system. Now they're saying that you can't get a voucher, or they're trying not to, and use that voucher to a private school because we can discriminate on our religious freedoms because it's tax dollars being used for you as a taxpayer. And to me, it's like we're talking out both sides of our mouth. And I think that if we're going to go, true fairness would be, in my opinion, if you don't want money coming to the private schools, I should be allowed to take, as a citizen, my money out of the public school and allocate it as an individual, if I want to the funding of my kids' private school education. Some states have adopted that and created tax breaks instead of vouchers. Because that's exactly the what they're trying to do is avoid the loophole that comes from taxpayer dollars being used to discriminate. And that's a lawsuit that's over our own voucher here in North Carolina right now. That is the exact issue that's being played out. And you can't say, well, there's always a private school that they can go to, and it doesn't have to be a religious one. Well, in Randolph County, the 100% of private schools are 100% faith-based. There's not a option. So that does add a little bit of validity of weight to their argument. I won't say that in deposition. but there is. So I think in fairness, I shouldn't have to fund Montclair Elementary, Jack Britt High, or any of the others, or John Griffith Middle, you know, the ones that I live near. That's just my opinion, though. And I think that's what comes down into this. So either we say that funding isn't an entanglement, or if we do say it is an entanglement, then there's got to be an option for those who have religious faith to be able to opt out.
Yeah, and what would that opt out look like at the federal level? I mean, let's not forget, this is the federal government funding child care.
Right.
I mean, how did we get to the point that the federal government is involved in pre-K child care to the tune of $400 billion?
Well, Hitler, that started back with President Obama, didn't it?
Well, I was going to say, Hitler said, give me your
youth. When we started running little school buses to take kids to school when it should be the parents' responsibility.
Right, but even more, I thought that was one of President Obama's agendas, was really pushing the, like, mandatory...
Kindergarten.
Mandatory
pre-K.
Preschool.
Pre-K,
right.
Pre-K, yep.
And it never really got through, but...
Yeah, because we were broke. I mean, let's not forget, there is no money for this. We're not sitting around, like, with a surplus of money going, golly, what do we do with all this money? What do we do with it?
And I think that's where...
for us as believers, we have to be willing to stand up and help others that aren't able to educate their children when they're younger, help them to be able to do that and not pass the buck on to the government. Because that's what the government's stepping in, because we know that children that don't have a well-educated background from home don't achieve in school. And so the government's trying to fix a problem that would be great for us if we could step up and be a witness and help our neighbors see how they can educate their children before they go off to public school or whatever school.
So, Mike, you're kind of pointing towards this idea that children who are in homes where adults are talking, where there's an interaction more between adults and children, that those children typically, statistically, measurably, quantifiably do better than their counterparts.
Correct.
How many words do I hear every day as a kid? How much engagement do I have? Someone directly talking to me, me talking back to them. All those kind of dynamics.
Yeah. And even just simply doing numbers at an early age. You know, how early in life do you start talking numbers and doing addition and different words and things like that? In a stronger home, kids just learn that quicker and earlier.
And therefore do better.
Yes. Continue.
Right.
From kindergarten on up.
And we're not saying kids can't catch up. There are kids who catch up, but not all of them, and there is a learning curve.
Yes, yes. There's definitely a steep learning curve. The longer it takes you to get to that minimum level.
Right. So are you suggesting here that because of that, the government does have a vested interest in from a society perspective?
I'm just saying that's where they're coming from.
Right.
They're trying to bring a solution to the problem. Now, I don't think that they're effectively bringing a solution to the problem. I think that they are encouraging parents to abdicate their personal responsibility of educating their children when they're younger. I realize some are having to work multiple jobs, and that's a challenge. But yet, as parents, we have to always own that our primary, you know, job in life is raising our children. And yes, there's a financial component to raising our children, but nothing replaces time with our children and helping them to learn at an early age. And so we have to try to help people to see that and understand that, because right now the trend is going the other direction. Let's just let the government do it. Let's just let, you know, somebody else do it at a school or a daycare. And we have to try to turn it back the other direction.
Yeah, and I think the hard part with that is that people just don't trust other people or organizations if they're not government-based.
But now, back to the money part, the part that really challenges me is, in most of the situations, it's not money that's going straight to the Christian daycare or Christian school. It's actually going through the parents. And it's a parent's choice on where the money is going and how it's being, you know, who it's going to. And that's what the government is trying to, you know, hold back on the religious freedom of the people. You know, parents that want to take that money for a daycare that is a Christian daycare that holds to similar beliefs. And that's the part that I think that they're way overstepping from a government standpoint.
So are you in favor of, you're not really in favor of spending the money, but if we are going to spend the money, then you're opposed to this extreme limitation, right?
Yes, that would be the two steps that, you know, in the long run, we need to do less from a governmental standpoint. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to do it, then we need to allow the parents to have a little more power over where the money is going.
Yeah, I just can't help to wonder, because, you know, we're so not engaged in what's happening. You know, so few actually even vote on midterm elections. So few are engaged on the real issues. Just imagine, Jack, the 45% of the students that we have, the families that are benefiting from this, and you send them a letter, and every head of school sends them a letter and says, please understand that if this bill goes through, next year we will not be at your child. You know, mm-hmm. would that create an uproar? Are they going to make phone calls? Are all these kids just going back to public school, Jack? Is that what's going to happen?
Can the public schools even handle them at this point?
You mean at large to deal with it?
Right. I mean, if you stop and you think about it, okay. So in the last 3 years, we have grown by 200 students. How many students do we have in the scholarship program? 200 students. Now, not every student of growth in these 3 years has been a scholarship student, but the basis is there.
Right.
If you're going to go a number for number. So somebody asked me today at lunch, if the lawsuit goes through and they pull the scholarship, will your school survive? I said, the school will survive. Not every employee will survive with a job. And it's just a simple fact. There'll be teachers that are no longer needed. And if we lose all 200 students, then we look like we looked like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Same size, same teaching structure. We just dialed the clock back 5 years. However we were scheduled, whatever positions we were filling, we pretty much began operating like that again and praying to God that we grow again. Back then, we were at a point where the building had just opened. We were able to make the payments. Everything else, things were a little leaner. We couldn't do quite as much as we're doing now, but we're going to survive. Admin staff will be smaller. Teaching staff will be smaller. We'll be smaller, but we'll survive. The thing of it is Fayetteville has grown. And those 200 students that came out, their seats were filled. By the growth of this town.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because the same person came back to our town after being gone for 4 years. Today was his first day back.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I felt like a way out. I was already in Fayetteville, where I usually would normally feel the growth of Fayetteville and the population of Fayetteville. I felt it many, many, many miles before then.
Sure. And you see that every corner.
And he goes, and I thought for a while there, this must be an isolated pocket, and it's going to thin out again before I get to true Fayetteville. And all I saw was denser and denser population as I came into you guys.
Yeah.
And he goes, so that tells me that Jack Britt, E. Melvin Honeycutt, John Griffith, just the schools around my neighborhood, mm-hmm. are not going to be able to handle the influx of students coming back. Not to mention, they're short on teachers. They're short on bus drivers.
Oh, they're short on everything.
They're short on food staff. They're short on everything because of COVID.
Your wife teaches in the public school. What is she experiencing?
Oh, yes. They'll handle it, but it's not going to be the quality of education because the class size will go much larger.
Well, they're already at, 1 to 30 yeah. in some cases. They're going to hit 1 to 40, 1 to 45.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask this question. Why, when they were given the opportunity to use the scholarship and come here, why did they make that choice?
Some for an environmental change. Some for a philosophy of curriculum change, but not necessarily for God. And some were like, praise God, we finally have an opportunity to have the Christian education we never could afford.
So if we put this in the terms of a fair market.
So I don't think all 200 will go back.
Right. So if we put this in the terms of the fair market, it would probably be safe to say that the majority of folks who left the public schools when they got an opportunity scholarship thought that the product and the environment at our school was going to be better than where they were, or they wouldn't have left.
Correct.
I mean, would you agree with that, basically?
Yeah.
Maybe a few were playing around. Well, I don't see.
We're not getting an overabundance from the Jack Britt School District.
Right. So,
but there are other school districts that we are.
So then my question is, if they take that away, why do not regular fair market rules apply, and the parents are just going to find a way to shell out the bucks to keep coming?
I'm thinking about a family right now that has 4 students in our academy.
Is it the one we were talking about yesterday?
Right. So it's affordability, right?
Yeah.
We have a lot of folks who say on a regular basis, if I could afford to come here, I would do it in a heartbeat. It's really, I had someone in parenting class last night say that.
Yeah, so I would have a choice. So, John, at that point, I would have a choice. I could say, okay, we've been looking to make strategic improvements, so let's forget that dream, right? Let's don't worry about the brick and mortar that's cracking because it's getting old and the time it's going to need to be replaced. Let's don't worry about the shape of the parking lot. Let's don't worry about the growth of the hedges. Let's don't worry about the windows and whether or not they're going to need to be resealed. You know, all the things that you're putting money into a sinking fund for, the parents don't understand that that's our margin and buffer. It's not like we're breaking even every year, but we're not breaking even for the fact that some year we're going to have to spend more to fix things because things life cycle out. And that's strategically planned.
So you're saying you're going to use that money to reduce tuition?
So if you took that money, margin, and reduced tuition to make it more affordable to retain some of these families and everything else.
But what? How much money would you need to make to afford a household? Your tuition at BBA for four kids would be $15,000.
Probably might be more than that, wouldn't it?
Four kids going to school.
About 20.
Okay, so how much money do you have to make annually?
After discounts.
Right, okay, so how much money do you have to make annually to have $20,000 a year going to Christian schools? I would say no less than $100,000.
Well, and that...
Unless you make extreme sacrifices.
Right, I mean, that would depend on what quality of living you...
Well, if you make $100,000, okay, 20% of that's going to go to taxes. So now you're at 80.
Right.
And now you're going to take 20 more off for Christian education. Now you're at 60. 60,000 with a family of six, that's what it would be.
Take off 10 for tithing.
Okay. If you're a Christian and you just don't have a desire to tithe, now you're at 50,000. That's $1,000 a week. That is not a lot of money in today's modern world of $3 gallon gas.
Not in the United States.
No, we're Fayetteville. Just Fayetteville. If you make $1,000 a week in Fayetteville, you're not considered wealthy. You're not living a great life.
No, what you're looking at is a return to a much older time period in our country when you're talking about multi-generational homes. Families living together, but yet our houses aren't big enough to handle that anymore.
And I think the second piece of the fair market idea was I actually think that this particular timing with COVID, the opportunity scholarship, all this going on in the public schools has effectively put a little crack in the foundation. And I'm not going to predict that it will crumble, but it certainly possibly could, in which people begin to realize that way too much money is going in that direction. And there will be more and more effort put into parent choice, and that particular groundswell will kind of leapfrog other ideologies like the LGBTQ and all that. And because of the fact that parents having all kinds of different agendas are going to be unsatisfied with the public schools and more realize that they can't afford to send them to private schools without distributing the money that they already pay in taxes back to themselves in order to make it. I think this is just going to continue to snowball, and that we're going to see a movement where it's actually going to go the other direction, and that public schools are going to be less funded and less looked upon as professional and able to do the job.
So if I can do a little bit of a spin in the conversation and leave that for a second and come back to when you talked about, could the public schools handle the students going back, let's look at the daycare, the pre-K level. To me, that's the area. I don't think there's enough daycares that are non-Christian to actually ever handle the students.
That's right.
Now, in public school, they'll have to handle the students because they just have to. But I don't think there's enough non-Christian daycares.
Because they'll have to create a whole new entity that doesn't exist.
Okay, so...
They can replace...
So, in other words, to tag on what you're saying, Mike, so what if they allocate $400 billion? It doesn't matter if they reduce 50% of the potential people that can service it, then you'll have your kid, but you won't be able to find any place for them because they have limits. All those places have...
That or you'll have entrepreneurs that are starting child daycares for open what and just taking the money to maximize on.
Yeah, you'll certainly have that, but their ability to get workers in today's environment will be incredibly challenging.
Yeah, because they'll have to stay home and take care of their kids.
The workers to fund these daycares that he's talking about.
Right, because that level of worker won't be able to have a job because they have to keep their kids at home.
Yeah.
And you're going to, and if you take it back up to the level above, you start the K-5, the first grade, second grade, and up, the same scenario kind of plays out is they're not, John, they're not pushing for us to go away. They're pushing for us to shut up when as they come to the door.
Right.
In other
right,
words,
we're not going to do that.
Right, but they want us to be able to. They want to be able to walk through our doors, as they are, and us hold no expectation for them to change to the to be a child of
right.
Christ.
Right.
Yep.
That there would be no pressure for conversion, abandonment of sin.
Well, I got that. But what I'm just saying is we're going to end up basically, like you said, Mike, where there's going to be nowhere they can go. So they're going to either have to choose this option, which they really don't like, or they're going to have to choose us, which, you, as you say, many of them are coming and saying, you know, don't grade me hard, don't say I have to be a Christian, don't ask me about LGBTQ stuff and shut up about that. But we're not going to, and I don't think many Christian organizations are going to do that.
They call me Z.
Right. And so I think there's going to be pushback enough that this is going to be quelled. In fact, I mean, I'm optimistic, and this could just be total insanity,
no.
But I think it pushes us back to an earlier time in the fact that more parents are going to be sent home from work. The things are going to shift and adjust back to maybe a more sustainable workforce picture.
And you don't understand me. Okay, so in the 1960s, what happened? Roe versus Wade, the removal of prayer from school, some of these elements took place, and Christian school teachers who had been teaching Christian values, who may have been able to openly share the Bible in the public school system, where there was this massive control. I remember I'm 1977, I'm starting school, I'm 5 years old, everything else, we're still praying in the school. I'm sorry, we're still having moments of silence. We're saying the pledges. You know, we're praying before games because it wasn't in the school building. It was outside the school building. I don't know how that one worked out, but they did it. You know, those kind of things. And, but what happened was is the Christian school movement took off. And the Christian teachers, you know, some stayed for various reasons, kept fighting the fight within the public school system, felt compelled and called that they could not abandon their kids, their community, that kind of thing, or there weren't enough of them to start a Christian school, so they stayed and kept fighting the fight as educators. Some, like Brian, started in 75, 76, and became Christian schools, got a bunch of educators together, created Christian school movements, things of that nature. And what happened was, is it was like, but they're still out there educating. They're still out there communicating. They're still out there trying to convert people. How do we shut them up more? Well, we got to get more and more out of the textbooks in the public school system. They accomplished that. Now they've come to the point where they, by and large, wholesale on the public school system. Not every individual teacher. The smart ones out there are wise as serpents and harmless as doves, and they know there are ways to legally wiggle themselves into having a conversation about Christ. They know how to prompt the child to ask the question, which then legally uncuffs them. And there are certain organizations that have wiggled in, and they're still slightly there present. But they have to come at the private schools now. Mm-hmm. They have to, because we're the only bastion. So now they're going to try to get into ours like they did the public schools in the 60s. So what we're experiencing in 2020 is what the public schools experienced in the 1960s. And what we don't know, and I'm glad you're as optimistic as you are, I know this. God made the Christian church survive Rome and Nero. We're going to survive the United States and now. is just.
I'm just so surprised to hear you so optimistic, John.
Well, it's going to be a challenge.
Well, it's optimistic and it's doomsday at the same time, because I think they go hand in hand. It needs to fall apart. Everything just needs to, because as long as we feel like everything's just hunky-dory and sustainable, we're just going to add trillions and trillions. We're just going to keep passing legislature that's undermining to the American family and to what we really know is right, which is the proper way that the family should be, honoring God. But honestly, as long as we're just happy, going along, it's like the frog boiling in the pot, just slowly. But if it just like falls to pieces, then I think that it's going to become very obvious who was right, from a, public policy, duh, you can't spend more than you make, you bring in, those kind of things. Because right now, nobody believes that, because we just keep doing it. We just keep raising the debt ceiling. We just keep passing these laws. And I don't feel bad about it. I mean, I'm driving a newer car than I ever have.
At some point, it is going to crash and crumble, right. Just like Greece. And
it has to.
Brazil.
And that's why I'm optimistic, because then it brings us back to where we should be.
Which one?
Venezuela.
Yeah, Venezuela. Yeah.
Because then the people with the work ethic, all of a sudden,
it's just, okay, your dollar's not worth anything. We're going to recreate the monetary system.
So, Pastor, just for a moment, though, I'd like to circle back to something that you brought up. As believers, we need to be more engaged in the life around us, in the life of the world, in the life of our country. To me, that does not mean we have to go out and protest and, be like way out front. But yet we have to be visible with our voting. We have to be visible with our conversations. So that we can really assert the influence that we have. Because we do have a great influence, but like you said, there's such a low voter turnout, we're not taking advantage of the voice that we do have. And so as believers, we need to take advantage of that and not let that slip away.
Yeah, I think if we had the ability to take a drone and follow the parents of the recipients of the North Carolina Opportunity Scholarship, and we followed them with the drone into the voting booth, what we would find is they're actually voting for politicians who are opposed to the North Carolina Opportunity Scholarship. The very
people... If they voted for Cooper, they are.
Yeah. Or even not going into the voting booth. Because many don't even go vote, those parents.
True.
But yeah, I'm with you that, yes, they're voting for people that doesn't support
there are people that are getting $5,000 and $6,000 and $10,000, $12,000 worth of free education, and their kids getting a much better education.
Yeah. So Representative Zaka of our region, John Zaka, retired military.
Mm-hmm.
He is a heavily in favor of the scholarship. He's one of the few Republicans in our region.
Right.
Voted to our Senate.
Right.
When it first came out, I remember attending a panel that had every representative on there. Zaka was the sole supporter. The six Democrats that surrounded him all said, "We do not want it." However, the constituency in the room was a high-voting Democrat constituency. They gave testimony after testimony after testimony of how favorable their experience was, how grateful they were, how this and that, and all seven of them voted in favor of an expansion of the scholarship because they heard from their constituency. So, John, in that aspect, there is hope. The problem that we're going to run into is that our Constitution at the state level definitively has language about taxpayer dollars going to organizations that are allowed to discriminate, and how it was structured as a thing versus being a tax break and being a complete voucher give. And the question is where is the money really coming from? I think that's what's going to boil down to. Where is the money really coming from? is it coming from the same pool of taxes that's funding the public education, or is it coming from some other type of revenue fees?
The lottery.
If it is, we might be okay.
Well, that's the whole reason they started the lottery, was to give more money to schools for education.
Because if they can prove that it's coming from our property tax, then there's going to be massive issues with it, because it's taxpayer dollars. If it's truly coming from the lottery, well, that's individual gambling. That's not a tax.
I think a good lawyer can make the case that it depends on who it's going to as well.
Well,
since it's not directly going to the schools, it goes through the parents first.
Yeah, and the thing of it is the lead legislator for that has volunteered, and he's doing it pro bono, so he is asking for, if he can get any donations to help with the legal fees, he's asking the schools to do that. But no school's required to pay anything, is the same guy who actually offered the scholarship. Mm-hmm. When it first came in, the rumblings were there 3 or 4 years ago. He stepped down, didn't run, left public office as a legislature, went back into law practice, and has been gearing for this the whole time. Wow. To actually be it. Gibbs Law Firm is partnered with him now. Because of my awareness to the ACSI National Headquarters, they were not aware of it. The National ACSI Headquarters Legislative Team is now partnering with him, and he's going to be the primary lead, and their sets of lawyers are going to correspond with him.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big deal. This is not a Fayetteville thing. This is the entire state of North Carolina, right, Jack?
Yeah, North Carolina is being sued.
Right. The state is. Right. For doing that which is constitutionally unacceptable in the state of North Carolina.
Which is to take taxpayers' dollars, directly or indirectly, and give it to a private school that can say, because of your religious beliefs, you can't come to our school.
And so what about the idea, Jack, of saying that we eliminate those admission requirements? We remain who we are with our values, our teaching, our staff.
But I don't think, I think at this point it's too far, because every school in the state would have to do that.
I'm not saying that it drops the lawsuit.
Right.
I'm saying let's say that at the preschool level, Jack, let's go full circle.
Okay.
At the preschool level. Do we care, in the grander scheme of things, I'm not really sure how many four-year-olds are going to have transgender behavior. You made the offhand remark a few minutes ago about the pronoun. What pronoun?
Z.
Z, the pronoun Z. You know, the parents, you know. I mean, I'm just curious about, because that's what it's going to come down to with this $400 billion. Could you still be a Christian preschool and not have those? Where would you run into hiccups with that? Your hiring practices?
Hiring practices, admissions. Let's say you just don't worry about admissions and you bring them in. Are you going to teach against it?
Or are you going to call the kid by their pronoun?
Is your curriculum
going to... You haven't had to do that yet, right, John?
Well, are you going to be forced to...
We have one in K-4 that the parents have determined that they are, you know, fluid or whatever. And so there's lower grades that are coming, but if they get to my grade, then no, I'm not doing it.
Yeah, I'm
not going to call what God's called female male.
And again, when I had my business meeting at lunch with this guy who's coming through town, he's telling me about another school in our region that has dealt with it already this year. And the fact that a second grader comes in dressed effeminately, pink bow, braids, girl lunchbox, girl clothing, not a dress, but girl clothing, and as a boy. You're going to tell me that 6-year-old, 7-year-old is the one who's making those choices? You get what I'm saying?
I do get what you're saying.
And now the Christian school is like, because what you're saying is if we don't worry about the admissions piece of it, okay, that's in the classroom. Now, how do we legally minister to that child and family? Well, if we say you have to take Bible class and we have to preach against it and things of that nature, we could still possibly be found religiously discriminating.
In violation.
Right, because we're discriminating. We didn't discriminate on our admissions practice, but we created an atmosphere of oppression and prejudice. I mean, and America loves nothing more in this world right now than the victim.
Yep.
Can't we just say stop it, or I'm going to bury you alive in a pine box?
Mm-hmm. What culture reference is that from?
That Bob Newhart thing?
Bob Newhart.
Stop it. Remember stop it?
I remember stop it. I don't remember the next part.
That was the final.
Yeah, the whole point of the woman that went into council with him, her issue was, she said, you know, when it came down to it, she said, "I'm afraid I'm afraid of being buried in a box." Well, and he said, "Has that ever happened to you?" And she said, "No." Well, no.
He's like, "Well, then stop it."
Then he said, "Just stop it." And then at the end, he goes, "Just stop it, or I'm going to bury you in a box." To, you know, get her out of the, break her fear.
With Brian not being here,
yeah,
I just realized that I'm the youngest one in the room. And
are you really?
That age reference that you guys just did with the Bob Newhart.
You missed it?
I missed it.
Oh, you got to go back and watch.
Are you really the youngest one?
Oh, you're not.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny.
You're younger than John?
Yeah, John's in his 50s.
I'm 51.
He's in his 50s now.
I'm 51.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Oh, you're not the youngest in the room then.
Maybe. Okay. When's your birthday?
February, right?
February 19th.
Are you the youngest?
I'm the youngest in the room, if that's the case.
Yeah, he's 41.
You're talking about being in school at 5 years old at 71.
77. I was born at 72.
I must have misheard. Sorry for digressing.
He's always here. He's going.
Never mind.
I understand your mind slips when you get older.
I digressed.
Nah, look at your hair compared to his hair. He's got.
Oh, I definitely have the oldest looking hair in the group.
No doubt about that.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, I'm just hoping that none of it goes through, because I don't want to see us spend another $1 trillion that we don't have. You know, that's just the bottom line to me, is that we...
Okay, so look, total unrelated but related. Do you think Biden's confession that he sees his own COVID stimulus as a prime factor of the out-of-control inflation? He made that remark.
Right, I know. But he may not remember that he made the remark the next day, but go ahead.
Well, that's true. That's very true. But do you think that's going to have any impact on the ability to get a vote like this through?
No, I think that the Virginia election is going to have the biggest impact. And these, look, for example, right now there are more Democrats that have already in the House that have said, "We are not returning. We are not returning." Don't. Than the Republicans. They're seeing the handwriting on the wall. That's the direction that we're going with this thing. The problem with the Biden is that there's no cognitive consistency. And that's a real struggle.
It is a struggle, and it's embarrassing on the international stage, too, because I've seen some newscasters in Australia.
Well, he flip-flopped it on Taiwan in a 24-hour period with regard to independence and not. And he talked out of both sides of his mouth within a 24-hour period. So whether he sees the stimulus that he infused into the economy as a contributor to the inflation that we're experiencing presently right now, He could literally have a moment where he cognitively sees it, but the ability to sustain that, to then the next time he has a staff meeting going, "Now let's talk about how we're going to fix this,"
may not be there.
It may not be there, and that's not a sinful criticism of the president. That's an acknowledgement that there is potentially a problem behind the scenes there, whether it's age or whether it's some other neurological issue. And why the American public is not concerned about it or doesn't see it is mind-boggling to me.
Because we don't want to see weakness in our leaders.
And I don't think he was running the show from the beginning.
But it comes back to, and none of us in the room believe that politics is going to fix everything.
No.
That the government's going to fix everything. But we as believers need to assert our right to vote, to speak out, like you talked about in that public forum,
mm-hmm.
to where people were speaking pro on something that would be assumed they would be negative.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be in the voter booth, but we also need to be speaking out when given the opportunity to try to help people to understand where we're coming from, because we have a greater influence than we're really using, and we need to take advantage of that as believers.
Yeah, it can be, I guess, kind of frustrating because we've said this, I mean, we started, you know, all the way back with the silent majority and that idea that, you know, if people would just, you know, infuse what they say they believe into their life, the difference that it would make in society.
Yes.
You know, as the whole idea of, you know, systemic is really built on the idea that the system is made of individuals who make the choices and, mm-hmm. and the decisions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you see both systemic things occurring because of the individual and the same responsibility at the individual level. And it's really kind of hard to break this concept of, you know, system and individual because we do live together and we're a nation and we're an organized nation of laws and that kind of stuff, but those decisions come from both the populace and the governmental seat from folks who are dead and gone. So we're living kind of in this in between this populace and the opinions that people have now and what the forefathers wrote into the Constitution and other documents and precedents from legal things that still kind of steer the ship in ways, a lot of times in which we're thankful because we think they had a little bit better handle on it in the past, not everything. But it really comes down to, I mean, at the most basic level, that we need a revival of every individual.
You know, it's funny you say that, John. 2 days ago, my junior class, we actually read Federalist Paper Number 10, written by John Madison, and we compared it to Patrick Henry's warning against a strong central government in his speech to the House of Burgesses in Virginia. And we were looking at the two of them together, and what we came to the conclusion was they both had the same hope and fear. The fear for both of them was, and Madison's was, we need a separation of power, we need a strong central government to keep balance, to keep order, to keep equality, because of the human nature to decline towards sinful greed and oppression of people. Henry's was, we can't have a central government because of
sinful
power to degrade and oppress people.
But both of them understood
the human nature.
Which we don't have today.
Which we don't have today. And that's the issue.
Big ideological shift.
And that's what I was trying to tell them was, is our Constitution wasn't written with specific language that it established a long-term government that would operate exactly the same. But it was written with broad enough strokes and a specific enough language that it was meant to control the human nature so that we could constantly evolve our government within a set boundary that controlled that human nature.
Sure. Like, why do you need, to wrap it up, because we went long, why do you need checks and balances if
right.
there is no sin?
Right.
There's no wrong then.
Right.
Yeah. So.
I mean, the best government period would be a benevolent dictator. Be the most efficient, right?
And why would you consider sheltering money in Nevada and those other places as some moral travesty?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
All right, well, thanks for listening to this podcast about what we're definitely going to see work out whether the bill gets passed. And whether the bill gets passed or not, there are cases going at both the state and the federal level to decide what are we going to do about all these faith-based organizations and the government money they're getting. So we'll have more to talk about in the months to come, especially when a court case comes on the radar. Thanks for listening. Bye.